Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Now, 77 WABC's continuing coverage of the Paris attacks. Live from Paris, France, here's Geraldo.
It's a turning point in one's life.
4 years you have been trying to keep this secret.
Yeah.
And you have said that you have been the victim of betrayal and extortion. You told me that a lot of people have actually demanded money to stay silent about this.
That is true. Yeah. And I have paid those people. Not that many, but enough to where it is. Depleted the future.
How many people have you paid?
I don't want to guess wrong. But enough to bring it into the millions. And that's what people forget is that's money they're taking from my children. You know, they think it's just me, but I got five kids and a granddaughter. You know.
All right, that's Charlie Sheen, and hearing his shocking announcement this morning. One of our most famous, or at least most infamous, celebrities on the public scene, Crazy Charlie Sheen, is HIV positive. Now, I had several reactions to this, and Noam, good morning to you from Paris. I want to start with one of those ironies that make you scratch your head. As you know, I'm here in the City of Light in Paris, covering this profoundly important story on the terrorist massacre that has totally disrupted French life and a lot of lives, including my own, in a relatively minor way. I mean, important to me, but in the grand scheme of things, not as important. I mean, 500 people who were killed or injured, my goodness, and their families. But anyway, I'm covering this important story, and it's got disturbing overtones for the rest of the civilized world. But I want to share this coincidence. Now, I've been in Paris, you know, many times over the years, but it's not like I hang out here in Paris. I don't hang out in the French capital, the City of Light. I don't hang out at the south of France. I mean, there are other places I tend to like, the Spanish-speaking countries, or, you know, Spain and Italy, you know, and so forth. But I was here in 1985. I was in Paris when a comparably famous American celebrity, the actor Rock Hudson, was brought here to Paris dying from, you guessed it, HIV/AIDS. Now, at that time, before there was an effective treatment for HIV/AIDS, the Rock Hudson story was huge. It was as big or bigger than Charlie Sheen for several reasons. First, we knew all along, we pursued him with our cameras, that Charlie Sheen was a whoremongering roustabout. I mean, he was living, for goodness sake, with three porn stars at the time he hit rock bottom, when he took on the producer of his show, Two and a Half Men. And that came after an endless orgy of cocaine and unprotected sex. With Rock Hudson, though, these many years ago, 30 years ago, HIV, the virus, and AIDS, the disease, still largely incurable. And it affected, or infected, I should say, mainly hard drug users and gay men. We didn't even know that Rock Hudson was gay. He was Hollywood's favorite leading man, the star of movies Magnificent Obsession, Pillow Talk with Doris Day, hit TV shows, Macmillan and Wife, Dynasty. So Rock Hudson came here to Paris in desperation to seek treatment at the famed Louis Pasteur Institute. And I came too. It was July 1985, doing a story for 2020 with Joey Lovett, the famed AIDS producer who really brought that disease and the fact that it was a sexually transmitted disease, along with hard drugs, that's another story. But Joe Lovett, working with my team on 2020, broke that story and brought it to the American public in a way it had not been. People weren't even talking about it. I mean, Nancy Reagan turned her back on Rock Hudson when she heard that he had AIDS. I mean, it was such a big deal. Rock Hudson had AIDS. He came here to the famed Louis Pasteur Institute, desperate. And I remember clearly, I'm not in the same hotel, but I have the same view out my window, the same view I'm looking at, the Eiffel Tower. So 30 years later, I'm talking about HIV, famous American celebrities with deep, dark secrets, looking at the Eiffel Tower and hearing about Charlie Sheen. Now, before I speak with Noam and with you all, here was Rock Hudson's words. The treatment did not work. We didn't know how to treat it, really, in those days. Here's what Rock Hudson said back in 1985.
A bedridden Rock Hudson's last words to Hollywood came via a message Burt Lancaster delivered at AIDS Project Los Angeles, September 19th, 1985, commitment to life fundraiser held at downtown's Westin Bonaventure. But the revelation that Hudson, 59, had AIDS and would be a part of the event transformed it into a charity blockbuster. I am not happy that I am sick. I am not happy that I have AIDS, said Lancaster, reading Hudson's words to a dead, silent crowd. But if that is helping others, I can at least know that my own misfortune has had some positive worth.
So Rock Hudson, Noam, died 2 days later. I mean, it just struck me when I heard the news today, driving from the location. We're at the Place de la République, where the French people go to mourn their losses, or when they are looking for solidarity, when they're looking, for camaraderie, they go to this Place de la République. And I was there, driving from there to the hotel to do the radio show, and I heard the Charlie Sheen news. And it just struck me, my goodness, I don't know, maybe I'm making too much of it, but I definitely had one of those moments. So strange.
Yeah, you know, and of course, when Rock Hudson said those words, it was earth shattering. I mean, it was called, it wasn't even AIDS, it was gay cancer, if you remember back in the early 80s. And if you remember after he made that announcement, he was the star of that hit TV show Dynasty at the time. And he had done a makeout scene with one of the stars, Linda Evans. And she had, she was worried. What's going to happen? I'd just done this makeout scene with this guy who had just come out with AIDS. I mean, the whole world was worried. And so in some ways, it was really heroic of him to come out back then. Where here, fast forward to 2015, Charlie Sheen's, it seems like a ripple compared to what Rock Hudson did.
And, with Charlie, you're absolutely right. This is a ripple. But it's still big news. I mean, when he came on the Today Show and Matt Lauer asked him the questions, and now there are all of the barrage of attacks that he talked about. First of all, I am curious about all of the extortion from the shakedowns that he calls it shakedowns that all of these, one of the prostitutes or porn stars who hung out with Charlie and was intimate with him will be joining us live later in the show. But this is a guy, Charlie Sheen, who at 50 years old, how old was Rock Hudson?
59 when he died.
Yeah, 59. But Charlie Sheen's 50 years old. I mean, you see him, he looks like hell. But that 2.5 Men, he was getting 1.5 million an episode on that show.
Wow.
When the national, when he had this breakdown, the coke and her fueled breakdown. But enough about, if you want to talk about Charlie Sheen, I will, or the Rock Hudson connection. But I have to tell you, folks, here I am in Paris, in this world capital, still very frustrated with the President of the United States, I have to say. And, we have not been unkind to President Obama. I think that in some ways, supporting the President of the United States is kind of a patriotic duty. But you can't be blind, deaf, dumb, and blind when even someone that you care for is making a grievous error. And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that to me, the president is way too cool for school when it comes to confronting ISIS and confronting the dreaded nemesis that this Sunni Muslim extremist group represents to the United States of America, obviously to Europe as well. But everything is tied in to what I'm talking about in terms of the military response to what ISIS has perpetrated here in Paris. The City of Light is still reeling from that horrible attack when so many lost their lives, 129, over 400 injured, totally disrupting life in the Parisian capital, or the French capital of Paris, and life throughout Europe. There's closing of borders now between Belgium and France, and other measures being taken. There's real concern, dread even, over the danger posed by the refugees coming out of Syria? How many hidden among them are people who want to kill us for no reason other than the fact that we are not, you know, of their particular faith, of their particular ideology? The response, the French now are bombing. The United States is bombing. The Russians are bombing. But I'm telling you, folks, bombing alone will not squash this threat that ISIS represents. They are a terrorist country. They control territory. They are creating weapons of mass destruction. And those weapons of mass destruction are the young men that they are unleashing on the world to kill as many innocent people as they possibly can, so-called soft targets, without caring at all for their own lives. It is stunning. It is a development we never thought we would see before, where suicide bombers have become a strategic weapon. And what happens, God forbid, as the weapons that they strap to their bodies as they're about to go to wherever it is they think they go are not merely high explosives, but biological, nuclear, chemical. And it's not the theater here in Paris or the sidewalk cafes, but Grand Central Station or Times Square. This is a real, clear, and present danger, and the president has to stop these half measures. He really has to declare war on ISIS. Until he gets the Congress of the United States to declare war on ISIS, these half measures will never work. They will never work. They may stop the spread of this cancer, but they will never cure it. Here is Bill Bratton, our police commissioner.
We have the capacity now in New York City to deal with almost two dozen multiple events occurring in the city with all of the resources we have available. So we can deal with the lone wolf, or we can deal with what appears to be the case in Paris, the coordinated multiple attack. We operate on the assumption if we have one of these attacks, their intention is to kill everybody that they get their hands on. So we will move very quickly to move in to stop that threat.
As in Paris, so in New York, today there are visible police on every corner, every street, every major street. I don't want to exaggerate here. It is very obvious to us that there is real concern. You know, ISIS has already announced that their next target is Washington, D.C. They will continue to launch these strikes. We should not have to depend on the thin blue line to protect us against these terrorists. We have to kill this disease at its roots, and you cannot do that with half measures like aerial bombardments. We must destroy ISIS. To destroy ISIS is to stem this flow, this flood tide of refugees coming our way, and I want very much to devote some time to my feeling that the response to the refugee crisis is hypocritical, partisan, political, self-serving. I want to get to that. But my main message is, Mr. President, please wake up. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 26 minutes after 10 o'clock. Geraldo live from Paris. Noam live from New York. Our studio is high above Madison Square Garden here in Paris. The heavily armed military-like police forces and their equivalent of the National Guard patrolling this city with their machine guns at the ready. Noam, describe the situation in terms of visible police in New York City right now.
You know, I did the walk around this morning where I walked from here, Penn Station, where we're above 17 floors above Penn Station, went downstairs. You can't tell much of a difference in Penn Station because on a daily basis, there's National Guardsmen with rifles at hand walking around Penn Station. But then I walked upstairs and I walked towards Times Square and then made the circle around. And yeah, you can see there's a lot more police out on the streets, and I imagine undercover ones as well. And then, as you probably heard yesterday, Bill Bratton, the police commissioner, welcoming in this new critical response team, the counterterrorism team. It's called the Critical Response Command unit. It's 560 NYPD cops, all who volunteered to be a member of this force, and they're going to have access to guns, vehicles, other gear in the event that there's a terror strike here in the city, like the one in Paris, where there's multiple events. And so Bill Bratton saying, after looking at this force and seeing the training that they've done, he says they're at the ready if there's a multiple, multi-pronged event like there was in Paris here in New York.
So help me out. Are they NYPD personnel that have been reassigned to this new unit, or are these extra people from other agencies?
It's a combination, but these are mostly police NYPD cops who wanted to be a part of this force, who volunteered to be a part of this force.
Gotcha. All right, let me go to Richard first. My first call, 866 Araldo is the number. Here's Richard in Queens. What's on your mind today, buddy?
Hey, Araldo. I totally understand your position with Obama's inaction. Right when this happened, the French, they closed their borders. I understand that you have a thing with the border and whatnot. But, you know, I saw you on Fox News. I saw your pain. And I saw that how helpless and angry you were when you saw that your daughter was in harm's way. I just want to say that I'm a father, and I have daughters as well. And I don't want to have that look. And I just want to bring it together because Kate Stein, her father, he doesn't have his daughter anymore because of the open borders that we have here. And I just want you to just please take another look and understand that the open borders here is the same inaction that you see in terms of terrorists, and you felt it came so close to you. And unfortunately, for people like me, it seems that it's getting close. And I don't want anything to happen to my daughter.
I got you, brother. I got you.
Here.
And, I'm not gonna argue the point. I do find distinctions that I will talk about as the program progresses. I am, for example, deeply upset over the partisan nature of the response to the issue of allowing any number of refugees from the Middle East into the United States. I think I have a plan that makes sense. I also want to say, let me say this before the commercial break, and Richard, thank you so much for your call, and God bless you and your daughters, and I hope you never have any of that stress that affected us, and then much more profoundly affected so many others whose children were affected much more directly and desperately than my family was. But, you know, here in Europe, you have had a flood of refugees coming from the Middle East, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them coming from this troubled area, many of them young men of fighting age. And I'm sure that most of them are economic refugees, but not all. Obviously, that one of the people who attacked Friday night was one of those refugees. Much more on this coming up after Noam.
And I think a lot of Americans have this frustration that they see that the United States has the greatest military in the world. It has the backing of nearly every other country in the world when it comes to taking on ISIS. And I guess the question is, and if you'll forgive the language, is why can't we take out these bastards?
Well, Jim, I just spent the last three questions answering that very question. So I don't know what more you want me to add. I think I've described very specifically what our strategy is, and I've described very specifically why we do not pursue some of the other strategies that have been suggested. Yeah, this is not, as I said, a traditional military opponent. We can retake territory, and as long as we leave our troops there, we can hold it. But that does not solve the underlying problem, eliminating the dynamics that are producing these kinds of violent extremist groups. And so we are going to continue to pursue the strategy that has the best chance of working, even though it does not offer the satisfaction, I guess, of a neat headline or an immediate resolution.
I was watching our president talking. Boy, he does not get it. And, you know, you hear the term radical Islamic terrorism. He won't say it. And you can't solve a problem if you refuse to talk about what the problem is. Somebody criticized me the other day. because they asked me what I do, and I said, I'm going to bomb the shit out of them. It's true. I don't care. They've got to be stopped.
They got to be stopped. Trump definitely more in sync with the mood of the American people, certainly the people here in France and the rest of Europe. You know, ISIS must be stopped. The president has to face the fact that for 2 years, we allowed ISIS to hold these big cities, Mosul, the second biggest city in Iraq, Raqqa, this large and important city in Syria. For 2 years, they have held this vast swath of territory. Yes, we're slowly nibbling away at them. And yes, the bombing campaign is degrading their capabilities. But as long as they hold that national territory, they will send their suiciders our way to inflict untold misery. And sooner or later, they're going to be wearing not explosives, but something far more dangerous. Okay, 866-Geraldo, I'm taking Joe in Brooklyn first. What's on your mind, Joe?
Hi, Joe. A couple of things, Geraldo, and I hope you give me time to get it off my plate. The first thing is 76% of the American public, as of yesterday, does not want more boots on the ground in Syria. They want more action against ISIS, but they don't want U.S. troops over there.
Hold it. I'm going to let you speak. I'm going to let you get all your points out. Just write them down so you don't forget them. Now, you say 76. I don't know where that survey comes
Reuters,
from. You're saying that three out of four American people surveyed do not want American ground troops on the ground. That's your point.
Reuters,
let's assume that the figure is absolutely accurate. It does not in any way change my opinion. I am an experienced war correspondent. I'm a patriot. I'm not someone who goes off half-cocked. I was wrong in 2003. A lot of others were wrong also. I was wrong to follow my president because my president told me what the danger was, and I believed him. It turned out not to be true. In 2003, Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. We invaded and disrupted the entire region for no good reason. I admit that. Our intelligence was flawed. He did not have weapons of mass destruction. In this case, there is no doubt who is launching these deadly attacks against us. There's no doubt who's cutting people's heads off. No doubt who sent the hideous, cold-blooded murderers who killed 89 young people in the theater a couple of miles from where I am right now, or raked through those cafes, or tried to get into that soccer stadium where 70,000 innocent souls, including the president of France, were watching a soccer match. We know it's ISIS. ISIS admits and brags that it's ISIS. That's a big difference. Now going to military strategy. It is impossible to quash a military government like ISIS as long as they hold territory. I said this yesterday, they're like the Nazis in Germany after they started losing the war. The Nazis dug holes. They continued to manufacture their war materiel, their tanks and so forth, and do research on their atomic bomb underground. Civilians were being killed by the bombs up on the surface. That's what's happening now. ISIS is no dummies. They know what's going on. They know about drones. They know about, you know, they can hear the jet sound. You can destroy their equipment up on the surface. You're not going to alter the course of the war without ground troops. You're not. Now, should it be all American? No, I think the Russians are perfectly placed to help out. So are the Turks, if they would be so bold and swallow their ethnic and religious sensibilities about going after an enemy that is also the enemy of their hated Bashar Assad, who's the other religion than they are. If it's not boots on the ground, then ISIS is going to be around for a long time, Joe. But I understand that I'm in the minority. I'm in the minority on the immigration refugee question also. But go ahead. What else is on your mind?
Right. So the other thing I want to say, as I was watching CNN over the weekend, and by the way, there were six countries that had terrorist attacks all through the Middle East and Bangladesh over the last 6 months. Very little news about that. The other thing I want to say was I was watching CNN over the weekend, and while people were giving their tributes at one of the restaurants, the right-wing kooks in France came around, 15 of them, protesting, get Muslims out of France, anti-immigrant. a crowd of about 100 people were going to beat the crap out of them. And I thought that was great. From what I see, the French are far more tolerant of Muslims than Americans are. All I've heard is jingoistic, bigoted rhetoric for the last 3 or 4 days. And I've heard from you also as of yesterday.
Jingoistic, racist rhetoric from me?
Bigoted.
Bigoted? Like what?
Yes.
That's baloney. Like what?
Oh, that the Mexicans are the ones that are paying the price after 9/11.
That's
fact,
bigoted to you?
Muslims are at the bottom of the immigrant line in terms of getting into this country since 9/11. They're the ones. The people that are immigrating into this country that happen to be Muslim are being affected by all of this.
I will address that. I need more than the time I have in this segment. But I think actually with your animosity, your background animosity, you hit a point that I think is important to discuss. Here's Dave, our friend Dave from Irvington, who is a Muslim, as I recall. Are you not, Dave?
That's correct.
Okay, so what's on your mind, buddy?
Yes, two things, Geraldo. I'm so happy, you know, to speak to you today, especially after these atrocities that took place over the weekend. First off, I'd like to appeal to President Obama. Mr. President, even though I didn't vote for you, I like you as a human being. Please, if you want to help the overwhelming majority of Muslims in this country and around the world, please get to work. Let's bomb the crap out of ISIS. Because not only are they killing Christians and Jews and other good people, but they're killing Muslims. You know, they would just as soon destroy my community as well as everybody else because we're not extreme enough for them. And I'd like to say to my fellow Muslims, come on, let us get up off the sidelines. Let us use the press, the internet, radio, TV, make phone calls, send letters, write op-ed pages. We've got to get up off the sidelines and join the rest of our brothers and sisters in condemning these religious perverts and letting the world know that they do not represent us in any way, shape, or form.
That's good, Dave. And I wish you could preach that from the pulpit of whatever mosque you attend, because I think it is a very important message. And I'm going to give you my own important message about refugees and immigration, following up on what Joe, the caller from Queens, raised earlier, but just give me a minute. Geraldo live in Paris, Noam Layden live in New York. But let me tell you about a debate I just had with Governor, former Senator, and former Governor of Virginia, George Allen. George Allen, on the one hand, says it is a hideous idea for whoever is suggesting that the only refugees we let in from Syria be Christians. He said that violates Thomas Jefferson, the famous Virginian third president, former a wonderful founder of the nation. Thomas Jefferson wanted a secular nation. We can't have religion as one of the litmus tests. I say, first of all, why not? Why in Europe, in World War II, wouldn't it have benefited humanity if the Jews of Europe were allowed into the United States, if those refugees could have fled from the Holocaust and given safe harbor rather than being turned away or denied visas, denied entry into the United States? The Syrian Christians and the other ethnic and religious minorities in Syria are similarly being killed off, their shrines desecrated, the religion, disappearing, Christianity disappearing from Syria. Why shouldn't that religion, the Syrian Orthodox Christians and the other religious minorities, persecuted minorities in Syria, why shouldn't that count in terms of the people we let into the United States, refugees from Syria? That's not violating our Constitution. That's being practical. Also being practical is what I call the shoe rule, shoe on, shoe off rule. If you go to the airport and you go through security and you're allowed to keep your shoes on, that means you're under the age of 12 or you're over the age of I forget what it is, 70 or 72 or 75. Because demographically, they have computed the risk from those age groups, the young and the old, and came to the conclusion that they represent no risk. So obviously, when you have religious minorities, when you have the old-timers and the children with their moms, particularly like a nursing mom, shouldn't they be given priority? What you have to avoid, it seems to me, in terms of the difficulty in vetting the refugees, in vetting, that is, in checking out their ID and their backgrounds and so forth, isn't it true that the ones you have to watch out for are young Sunni extreme? Well, you put aside, let's say you can't determine whether or not they're extremists, but young Sunni Muslims of fighting age, of fighting men in their 20s. Men in their 20s are at least half of the refugees fleeing Syria, probably more than half, although we tend to emphasize the women and the children. It's young men of fighting age who make up at least the majority, at least 50% of the refugees fleeing Syria. Why not have a demographic test like the Israelis do? It was Governor Jeb Bush, who is not a radical right winger, who suggested some aspect of profiling. It should not be a dirty word. It's pragmatics. It's understanding what the reality is. I believe that the right wing in the United States is using complaints like, oh, no, we can't have a religious litmus test, to exclude all refugees and all immigrants from Syria. They're saying we can't have a religious test. Oh, no, that would be un-American. On the other hand, we should not allow anyone in. Not only the Christians, we shouldn't let the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Alawites, the, you know, you name it. You fill in the blank there. So they're using it, I think, as an excuse not to let anybody in. And I also am deeply disturbed by the fact that this is coming down, not exclusively, but pretty much primarily along party lines, around partisan lines, like the governor of Connecticut and the governors of Oregon and Washington are saying, okay, we'll take refugees. Chris Christie, the hard nose running for president from New Jersey, he says, no, we can't take any refugees. And all throughout the Deep South, all of those red states, no refugees. Those are the same people going after Planned Parenthood. Those are the same people who, you know, were after gay marriage and immigration when immigration was just a question of people coming from the southern border. And demographics is what I'm talking about when I'm saying, there has never been a terrorist penetration from the southern border. The Mexican Christian people coming in, I'm not being a bigot here, they have nothing to do with ISIS.
I've never been more concerned. I read the intelligence faithfully. ISIL is not contained. ISIL is expanding. They've just put out a video saying it is their intent to attack this country. And I think we have to be prepared. I think hopefully France will go for a Chapter 5, which will bring NATO into it. Hopefully we will work with our allies to put together the kind of coalitions and attack plans in more than one place at a given time. There's only one way we're going to diminish them, and that is by taking them out.
Dianne Feinstein, Senator Dianne Feinstein, California. Bill Hemmer's a cherished colleague of mine. I love the guy. He co-hosts with Martha McCallum America's Newsroom, the hit Fox News show from 9 to 11 Eastern Time every morning. And he joins us live. He's here in Paris with me. We've been working alongside each other all morning long. Bill, where are you now?
It's great to be with you, Gerardo. Thank you. 5 o'clock in the evening. We're over at the Republic Square, which, you know, the offices are starting to wrap up the day here in Paris. And you know, this is when you get hundreds of people who live in Paris who come by this monument to pay their respects, and that's what we're seeing again. It's a rainy, chilly night, and I think it reflects the mood here. You know, it strikes me, Gerardo, 11 months ago, they had a rally in central Paris with 1 million people organized by the government. Everybody came out, and that was when the Charlie Hebdo newspaper was hit. And you don't hear any of that talk now about rallies or calls for unity. And you think about some of these neighborhoods with these tight-knit communities that exist here throughout this country and also in Belgium.
Bill, let me play
it's a
bite.
There are two different. I guess my point. There are two different planets here, Geraldo.
There are two. Here is you. I want to play you a tape of you from yesterday. Here's Bill Hemmer.
If you were waiting to hear a U.S. president say, "I feel your pain," or if you were waiting to hear a U.S. president say, "It's them or us," that is not what you just heard. President Obama called the attacks here in Paris a setback at one point. He was asked, is it time for you to change your strategy? More or less, he said no. Have you underestimated the abilities of ISIS? More or less, he said no. Do you understand how to defeat ISIS? His response, this is a variation of the same question. President Obama has made it quite clear in that Q&A that lasted more than 45 minutes that he has accepted there are evils in this world and evils in places like Paris, France. And this is something that we all must face today. It's a reality in which the world we live.
You know, that's the Bill. I think that you were absolutely superb in your eloquent description of the president as being too cool for school. What is it? He's a smart, sharp man. He wants the best. He's a patriot. He wants the best, obviously, for the country, even selfishly for his own legacy. What is it that he doesn't get that so many of us see as we look at ISIS as the dreadful nemesis that it is?
Yeah, my sense is, Geraldo, if you look at the polling, 70% of the American people don't think we've got a strategy to beat it. And their concerns, well over 60%, that they could be a victim themselves. And my reaction was just reflecting what I found out here on the ground. And I think that's what the French people feel. They feel now that any one of them could be a victim. They don't have to be part of the military. They can be regular everyday citizens. And they, too, can go to a concert on a Friday night and be taken out. And that's why you have the reaction that you have throughout this country. As for the president, his card is this. We've got a strategy. It's going to take some time, but it's going to work. Is he right?
I'm not so sure. I don't think that you can defeat ISIS with air power. I think that that is a passion that rapidly expends itself. The French are all eager and watching and cheering on as their bombers hit Raqqa in Syria, the ISIS stronghold there. How long will that emotion last? And then ISIS will come out of their foxholes and then send some other suicide bomber, you know, mixing up with the refugees. Let me ask you that. Isn't it deeply disturbing, this, but it's reality, how there is a backlash now against this flow of refugees pouring across from Turkey into Europe?
Yeah. They found that Syrian passport, they say, near the body of a suicide bomber at the stadium where your daughter was on Friday night. There has been no system to control and account for 800,000 men, women, and children coming into the continent of Europe. Geraldo, I read at one crossing between Austria and southern Germany near Bavaria, there are 5,000 people a day. The system is not in place to organize or to process. I can understand the concern, certainly, and I think you can as well. But those people aren't going back, and they are here in this continent, and these 26 or 28 countries have to deal with it. Listen, they started 30 years ago here in Europe to break down their borders. They wanted people like you and me and other people living in France and Germany to travel without a passport or to travel visa-free. Well, they have that now. And as a result of what we're seeing based on this terrorist attack, they're questioning the very system they pushed 30 years ago, starting in 1985.
Bill Hemmer, Fox News correspondent, host of America's Newsroom. If you don't already catch it, 9 to 11 every morning, along with Martha McCollum, a dear friend and neighbor of ours. Bill, thanks. And I'll see you out there in the Place
de la République. Good to be with you, man. I'll see you soon, Geraldo. Thanks.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. All right, what are you thinking? Let me take John in Brooklyn. Hello, John. What's on your mind, buddy?
Thank you for taking my call. 2 points. Actually, it's going to be three. Number one, where do our leaders get off on asking us to pick up the bill for these refugees? They have nothing and they're coming here. Why do I have to pay my taxes for them? Second thing, the Sunnis that you are constantly sticking up for follow Sharia law. Do we really need Sharia law in this country? It's a setback for all of our values. They treat their women like crap, and it's disgusting. Now, the last point, Geraldo, is Mexico, because I'm going to blast you. You know where the real terrorists are? In Mexico. And I'll tell you why. Because they deal drugs to our children. And our children die on the $5 bags of heroin. And you never hear any of our leaders say anything about that, Geraldo.
No, that's not true.
What we should be doing, oh no, it's true. And what we should be doing is...
I mean, you sound like Donald Trump in his announcement speech that the Mexican immigrants are drug dealers and rapists, and it's just factually incorrect.
It comes back to the Mexican government. They're a form of terrorism. They're supporting these cartels, Geraldo. We should be spending in our special forces to destroy them and wipe them out. There's $5 bags of heroin in Long Island, in Manhattan. How is that being done? And you're constantly defending the border issue, Geraldo? Come on. Get
you know, the heroin use, and the heroin comes primarily from Afghanistan and the Golden Triangle. It comes from Southeast Asia. I'm not denying that some comes across the border, but the vast majority of the people coming across the border have nothing at all to do with drugs. And they really are, there is a need here, of course, for law enforcement. There is a need for drug treatment. There's a need to stifle, to stem, to reduce the demand for these hideous drugs. There is a need for personal responsibility. I understand that heroin addiction is the biggest issue in New Hampshire right now, the first in the nation primary state. I get that. And I get that we need border controls. I'm not against strong borders. I'm for pragmatic idealism. I'm for things that work. I'm for understanding that you can separate the wheat from the chaff. I am for an even-handed approach to life that is based on pragmatics and the American spirit and on working together to solve problems. The first problem we have to solve, you're talking about heroin. I don't think that the vast majority of our listeners right now are concerned that they're suddenly going to be junkies. And I've covered drugs and drug use for years and years. I understand what's going on now in working class families and in middle class families where young people have been stealing the meds from their parents or who've been getting oxycodone or one of these other barbiturates or opiate drugs from their doctors and that have been cut off because of the stringent nature of controls on prescription drugs and are turning to heroin. Heroin is something that will always be around. We've got to voluntarily reject it. You can get it. People don't become heroin addicts because heroin is coming across from Mexico. They become heroin addicts because they can't get their pharmacological drugs. They have something desperately wrong with their lives. They shoot up. They don't think they're going to become addicts, and they become addicts. You can't blame Mexico for America's drug problem. I blame ISIS for killing people, direct murder. It's murder. Those people didn't have a choice in that theater. Those people in those cafes here in Paris did not have a choice whether or not they were going to be killed or not killed, whether they were going to become victims of ISIS and terrorism. They had no choice. They had no personal responsibility for what happened to them. They were the victims of a vicious, murderous clique. And in terms of Sharia law and these people that Muslims bring in Sharia law, we have 4 million American Muslims now. I haven't heard of Sharia law any more than I've heard of some of the other religions that have their own kinky rules and requirements about women and so forth. I'm for religious freedom as long as you don't impose on me. And I'm for reason. I'm for reason replacing emotion. The reason I'm mad at the president of the United States now is because I reason that he is wrong in his calculation as to the threat posed by ISIS. It's not emotional. I may be impassioned about the topic because, among other things, it came so close to my own family. But I think that I am rational. I think I am reasonable. When I say that it is possible to get 10,000 Syrian refugees who are absolutely, totally, 100% vetted and non-terroristic, it's because I know it's possible. I know that there's babies and old women and Christians and other religious minorities that have nothing at all in common with ISIS except for the fear they have of ISIS. They must be destroyed. ISIS must be destroyed. I want every drug cartel runner in the world behind bars or dead also. But note the difference. The victim of terrorism has no responsibility, has no choice. The victim of heroin makes a choice. That's not that I forgive the people providing the drug. I don't. I want them all. They're scum. They deserve to be dead or in jail. But people have to make a choice not to use heroin. But to mix heroin with terrorism, I think, is to accept in the most cosmically general sense to really be in many ways sophomoric and naive.
And I want to say this to the television audience. I made my mistakes, but in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination, because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
President Richard Nixon on this date back in 1973 telling the American people that he is not a crook. He was not a crook, but he did obstruct justice, but he was not a crook. Richard Nixon came, actually, ironically, to be regarded historically as a pretty good president until he got in a jam over Watergate, a totally unnecessary excess that he could have easily. He was trying to undermine George McGovern in the 1972 presidential election. George McGovern was trounced by Richard Nixon in that election. It was totally the Watergate burglary and the cover-up that followed, totally unnecessary. Richard Nixon, upon threat of impeachment, he was not impeached, unlike Bill Clinton. He was not impeached, Richard Nixon. He chose instead to resign. Bill Clinton fought it out, was impeached, and then was acquitted by the Senate of the United States. Here's Stan, our buddy in Forest Hills. What's on your mind?
How are you, my friend?
Good.
Listen, Geraldo, what do you know that the President of the United States doesn't
know? I don't know. What does he know that I don't know? I don't know.
What does the Senator of California know that the President doesn't know? She's
a Democrat.
And here's the answer. Well, here's the answer. The answer is the President, obviously, speaks to the generals every day. He gets three or four hearings on the information of what's going on in this war. I believe, like you, I think he means well and so forth. There is something being told to him that he's either not getting or that he is getting, and he's getting the information, that if he waits a little longer, things will get much better. So it has to be coming from the generals.
Right, and you know, Stan, I love that you give the President of the United States the benefit of the doubt. But let me just give you an example. The United States in the last several days has started bombing oil trucks coming from the ISIS-controlled territory, going into Turkey and Jordan and so forth, going into countries where it was sold, where oil is to be sold. So we started hitting the oil trucks. This came days after Trump said, why don't we hit the oil facilities? Why is it that we never hit the oil trucks in the last 2 years? Why is it we haven't taken out the oil infrastructure that provides a million or so a day or more to ISIS to fund their terrorist activities? You know, when that happens, if anyone out there listening right now knows the explanation for that and can put it in, can spin it so that the President of the United States looks good, please give me a call. Because for the life of me, although again, I root for his success, I'm not an ideologue, I want him to be successful. Why have we not been bombing the trucks, the oil trucks, up until now? It just doesn't make any sense. It's like the question we gave the French bombers, the coordinates of their targets that they hit when France responded to the horrible terror attacks here in Paris. Why didn't we take out those terror targets before the French got involved? We are fighting this war against ISIS in a half-assed fashion. Drones are great. I am all for drones. I think drones are far superior to manned aircraft. Why? Because we reduce civilian collateral damage. We pinpoint the target and we hit them as I hope we got Jihadi John. But you cannot win a war with drone strikes or aerial bombardment. You just can't. We've got to get them before they get us. And I don't know what the president knows that I don't. It's baffling to me. Here's Justin in Fairlawn. Hey, Justin, what's up?
Yes, hello, Geraldo.
Hi, you're on, Justin. What's up?
Yes, the reason for my call is, again, thank you for taking my call. The 2 points I just wanted to make quickly. The first is the carnage perpetrated by these Islamic terrorists in Paris could be thwarted in a way, too, by having armed citizens, even in our own country, legally armed citizens. And that would have cut down some of the carnage that may have that occurred there. And my second point is bombing is not going to do it alone. I think by having mercenary forces in that area from all over the world to take on ISIS might be a start.
I missed that last point, Justin. What do you mean having a mercenary?
By having mercenary forces open up, having a coalition of mercenary forces.
Oh, you think like a French Foreign Legion kind of thing?
Yes, that's correct.
I think you need a military. Thank you. We need a military response to what was a criminal military activity here in Paris. I like the idea of a foreign legion. I've always advocated one. Professional soldiers working for some greater good, maybe the United Nations. I don't know. I loathe the idea of American GIs losing their lives or America's taxpayers losing their treasure to pursue a foreign enemy. But I think in this case, ISIS represents such a threat that we need to go after them.
I'm here to admit that I am in fact HIV positive. And I have to put a stop to this onslaught, this barrage of attacks and of sub-truths and very very harmful and mercurial stories that are about the threatening the health of so many others, which couldn't be farther from the truth.
That's Charlie Sheen admitting in a dramatic story. It's a small story. It involves one person. Actually, it doesn't involve one person. It involves everyone he ever slept with. Not as cosmically important as the fight against terror, but it certainly is commanding a lot of attention today. Charlie Sheen making that revelation on the Today Show with Matt Lauer this morning. Someone who knows Charlie and his habits very well joins us right now. Alex Datig is a former Heidi Fleiss call girl. Heidi, she had the Fab Five call girls, $5,000 a night. Alex was one of them. I don't know if she ever partied particularly with Charlie Sheen, but we'll ask her. Alex, how are you?
Good morning, Geraldo. Thank you. I'm doing fine, and thank you for having me on.
All right. So, what was your reaction when you heard the news about Charlie Sheen when he announced that he had HIV?
I was really, really angry because in 1992, I was in prostitution. Now called sex work, but then it was called prostitution or high class prostitution. I was in for 9 months. By the way, the average time someone is in that is 7 years. But I was in for 9 months, and it terrified me. And I was a model at the time, and I Heidi Fleiss found me, and I worked for her, and I ended up turning her in. And here's the reasons why. One of the reasons is I was sent to Charlie Sheen's house. I was paid $5,000, of which Heidi Fleiss got $2,000, her usual 40%. Charlie Sheen was having a party for the Cincinnati Reds baseball team where he invited the entire team to his house in Malibu. He had topless waitresses, and so I was there to go and service the baseball team plus Charlie Sheen with four other women. I walked into that. I was a former rape survivor already by that time, and I walked into that house and I saw what was going on, and it was a scene right out of Caligula. I walked into his bedroom and I remember seeing Charlie Sheen on the bed, high as a kite, naked, unaware of his surroundings, with five other women on the bed, one jumping up and down, one playing with a watch. And I looked at that situation. I said to myself, I am not doing that. And I remember I was so disturbed that night. I got ambushed by some of the players, taken into a separate room, and it re-triggered my a gang rape that I went through when I was 16 years old. I went home and I nearly killed myself, Geraldo. I'm sorry. You know what? It's bringing up a lot of hurt feelings.
How many people, or do you credit Charlie Sheen when he says that he never infected anyone because he was cautious? Was he cautious as far as you saw?
Are you cautious when you're high? You know, are you cautious? You have a drug addiction is a loss of impulse control. Some people's more than others. But we all know Charlie Sheen has had a terrible battle with drug addiction. And his battle with drug addiction has led him to this place. I myself have had a battle with drug addiction. God willing, I'll have 17 years sober this coming New Year's Eve. But Charlie Sheen, I have forgiven Charlie Sheen because what he really is a sober brother who has relapsed and who hasn't found a way.
But how many women do you think he infected with HIV, if any?
I don't know, but I know that Charlie Sheen has had an insatiable appetite for sex, and I think sex addiction is his problem, because when he went from prostitutes to porn stars, which prostitutes are there to take your money, porn stars are there to have sex with you. So that's the difference between the two. So that's what Charlie Sheen wanted, sex. That's what he wanted. He wasn't getting enough from the prostitutes, so he went to the porn stars, and I think it's quite possible that that's how that whole thing unraveled. Did he give it to other people? We won't know for years because HIV lays dormant for many years, just like many viruses lay dormant for many years. If you're infected with the herpes virus, you will show false positives in blood tests. It will only show a positive, as far as I know, is when you are having an outbreak. So
Alex Datig is my guest, the former Heidi Fleiss call girl. You later turned witness against Heidi Fleiss. Now, in this situation, Charlie Sheen says that the reason he came public is that he was being blackmailed, extortion in the millions of dollars. Is that true? If so, by whom?
I've read those stories, and I have no doubt in my mind that he's telling the truth there, because that's the life he's living. And sadly, he's come out and said, well, I'm coming out because of these shakedowns. And apparently to the women who were the goddesses, or one of the women, I've read stories that, you know, one of the women that had been publicly in a relationship with him at some point, who also was a porn star, was extorting him somehow. So I know that is part of the case. And for him to come out and say, well, I'm HIV positive, and I'm coming out because I'm being extorted, he hasn't really figured out yet what's going on. This is the end of the line. He has to change. You either get sober and you change, or you end up in jail, dead, or insane. If he continues to live his life the way he's living, he is on that path. He has given that virus to people, and he has slept with people in the last 4 years and has not disclosed it. He has recklessly endangered those people's lives, and that is a crime in many states. When you have HIV, you are required to disclose it. So he's headed down a very, very bad path. And this is a wake-up call, America. Geraldo, you often say, go home and hug your kids. You know, and by the way, I'm sorry what's going on with your daughter in Paris. My heart goes out to you. But that's the fact. Go home, hug your kids. Be grateful for what you have in your life. And don't think there's anything out there that you still need to get. If you've got it in your life, live in the moment and love your family and be faithful. Because what you're doing out there, if you're out there doing what Charlie Sheen's doing or anything close to it, it's not worth it. It's going to have a price tag attached to it, a hefty price tag.
Alex Datig, thank you so much for coming on. I know that now you're doing the righteous thing. You're helping other people, and I appreciate you coming on the program this morning. Thank you so much.
I'm honored, Geraldo. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, sweet. Welcome back at 10 minutes to High Noon. Rick Leventhal is an excellent reporter. He is a dear friend of mine. We've been working shoulder to shoulder for a decade and a half. He's a senior correspondent at Fox News, and Rick joins us live right now. Hey, brother, where are you standing right now?
Geraldo, we're back in Republic Square, where there are people gathered despite the rain to pay respects, light candles, place flowers, and just sort of mourn the loss of so many so senselessly here over the last few days.
So what do you think the mood is as you see it? Is it melancholy? Is it anger? Is it worry? You know, what exactly are you saying?
You know, I think all of that and then some. You know, this number of people have told me, French people, that this is their 9/11. And we have to remember what New York was like after 9/11. And there was a dark cloud hanging over our city for weeks, and if not months, after that event. And granted, they didn't have two large buildings brought to the ground, but they lost hundreds of people, you know, 129 killed and 350 wounded. It's a lot of lives shattered. And so, you know, there's sort of a subdued nature, I think, to the community here and the people here. They're angry, they're upset, they're mourning, and they're, I think, confused about where to turn and what to do next.
I agree with that. Do you think that they are, you know, abandoning the traditional French welcome for immigrants? You know, after Charlie Hebdo, I was talking with Bill Hemmer earlier, they marched together, solidarity, you know, the Muslims aren't guilty. Now I don't sense the same kind of expansive, we're all in this together. I may be wrong, but it's just not my vibe.
That's true, but we also have to consider that mass demonstrations have been banned by the French government in the wake of these attacks. So they're not allowed to stage the massive rally we saw after Charlie Hebdo. There were a million people here in and around this particular square, and I was in the middle of it. It was insane. It was an amazing and an incredible outpouring, one they hadn't seen since D-Day. But now they're not technically allowed to do that. And also, I think the nature of that attack, which was a much smaller in scale to this, has changed, I think, the reaction. And there is, I think, a growing sentiment that perhaps we've been too accepting and too forgiving, and we have to be tougher. And that's what the French president has been saying, how they need to add security, they need to have extra police powers, and they need to get more aggressive in rooting out the radicals among them.
My fellow senior correspondent at Fox News, Rick Leventhal, dear friend, office mate of mine, joins us. You know, on our channel particularly, but generally speaking, I think even much broader than Fox News in terms of the news media in the United States, the president is being criticized for a kind of tepid response, Rick, so far. He's not come out with the strong language, we're going to bomb you into the Stone Age, we're going to massively, you know, destroy you and all this. He's trying to temper down expectations, trying to pull people back. He's gotten a lot of criticism for that from both sides of the aisle, as I said. What's the feeling as you see it in terms of the Parisians and the president, not President Hollande, President Obama? Is there a feeling that the U.S. is doing enough to fight this nemesis?
I have not heard any anything from anyone criticizing the U.S. response so far. That sentiment may exist. I haven't heard it. But we have seen a very strong response from the French president, who has pulled no punches here. The president of the United States did not come here, and he didn't come here after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in January. He sent Secretary Kerry then, and Secretary Kerry is here now. Secretary Kerry is saying that the U.S. will do everything it can to assist the French people. The French president is actually going to Washington next week. But as far as we know, the U.S. president is not coming to France. So I'm not sure why that is, that there may be some resentment connected to that. But what we have seen today, Geraldo, is the French government calling on its European Union allies to step up, invoking a never-before-used article of the EU Lisbon Treaty, which asks all the member nations to give aid and assistance to a member country that's the victim of armed aggression on its territory. That clearly happened here. So now the defense minister is saying to the other EU countries to help them by either joining this bombing raid that they're taking over Syria and Iraq, or providing some other kind of support, presumably security support, so that maybe they'll have more officers to do the investigations. We've seen close to 300 police raids in just the past couple of days, Geraldo, as they search for accomplices and suspects. And just one more point on that. We are now learning that there is a second fugitive being sought who was directly involved in the terror attacks. We know that you know, they were looking for that one guy, Salah Abdeslam, who handled logistics and rented one of the cars, and he's on the loose. And we know they're looking for the mastermind. But now there's another, at least one other terrorist who they say was directly involved in the attacks who's on the loose. And, you know, yesterday, Geraldo, we heard that a woman might have been involved. We don't know if this second person is that woman or yet another person who they're hunting for now.
So as they hunt, there is anxiety gripping everyone and anger and melancholy. And Rick Leventhal, you're a great reporter, and I appreciate very succinct presentation just now. And you're a dear friend. Thanks a lot, mate.
Thank you, Geraldo.
All right, I'll see you out there. So, Noam Layden.
Yes, sir.
What do we know?
What do we know here in New York?
What do we know
in generally? You know, I think the big argument over the coming days, of course, is going to be what you've been talking about all morning, the president's response to all this. And it seems tepid, but is there something he knows that he's not going to share with us and he's just going to let the media butcher him and he's fine with that? Or is there something, or is he just not alert and out of it? I don't know. I don't know because I'm not in the White House. And then the secondary question, which might be as big, are we going to change who we let into this country? Are those Syrians who've struggled through the civil war for the last couple of years who would love to get to our shores, who are innocent people, most of them, are we going to stop them from doing that? And what's going to happen to those people? Are they going to be in limbo for another couple of years? And that's going to involve, you know, men, women, children, all kinds of people.
I think that on the issue of the president and what he is doing, I just, whatever you think about where he ended, his bottom line, there is no doubt. But either he was not feeling well, he was ill-prepared, he didn't want to make promises he didn't think he could keep. But I think that was one of the worst public presentations I'd ever seen a president make at a time of national emergency.
What would you have rather him done? Did you want him to pound his lectern and scream and yell? I mean, I don't know what you want.
It's not a question of even passion. It's a question of reason, of having a rational line of thought. This is what we need to do. This is how we're going to do it. And we're going to start right now, not making false promises, but making succinct, understandable promises.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.